Greetings, beloved family. I begin in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I bear witness that there is but one God. Welcome to the Black Agenda Conversation. And, of course, we're on the Facebook page of the Black Agenda Project Organization, which is facebook.com/blackagenda. This evening, we have a very interesting and a very important topic for you. A subject that has been edited, rewritten, revised, distorted. It has been misrepresented, misinterpreted, misunderstood. And now we want to shed some light. The July 27th, 1990 Muslimin coup in Trinidad and Tobago, led by Imam Yasin Abubakar, was the only Muslim-led revolution that overthrew a government in the Western Hemisphere in the history of this new world. Imam Yasin Abubakar passed away 2 days after his 80th birthday, which was on October the 18th. He was born just 100 and something days after Kwame Ture, and he passed away on, it would have been October 20th into the 21st, this year 2021. And since his passing, of course, needless to say, his life has been looked at again, and this time we want to really give the facts. I first met Imam Yasin Abubakar in 1993 on August the 1st, Emancipation Day, where he showed up at one of my lectures. I was 22 years old, and this would have been at Prince Street in Port of Spain. It was on Emancipation Day, and he just passed through. He spent about 45 minutes, but he left to go up to the Savannah before I had finished. So I didn't meet him and greet him on that day, but of course we connected. And from that day to up to a couple weeks back, we have spent several hours, to be honest, over the last 30 years, maybe thousands of hours in conversation. Up to just recently, Republic Day, September 24th, where we spent the afternoon together at my office at the Kwame Ture Center. Now, I want to get right into this, but I want us to listen from a neutral position. I know that there has been so much said on this subject. I'm going to stick to the facts. We're going to present the information. But I want us to also travel through time somewhat, because there are many things about the 1990 coup that have been not just forgotten, but literally changed. Because the way it's seen now in 2021 is very different to how it would have been seen in 1990 going into 1991. So, let's get into it. And I pray that we are open-minded, broad-minded, objective, and that we think. So, probably more so than any other event ever in all the history of Trinidad and Tobago, has the truth about one event been so distorted, reconstructed, and stage-managed many times for political mileage of individuals involved or vying for office in Trinidad. It was on July 27th, 1990, where 114 members of the Jamaat al-Muslimin, Muslims led by Imam Yasin Abubakar, went into two locations in the city of Port of Spain, the capital of Trinidad. One group went to the Red House, which is the parliament building. That group was led by Bilal Abdullah. The other group went into the television station headquarters, TTT, Trinidad and Tobago Television, which at the time was Trinidad and Tobago's only television station. and Imam Yasin Abubakar did a live broadcast to the nation announcing to them that their government has toppled, that the Jamaat al-Muslimin has taken over, they have a list of demands, and that God is in charge. There was, of course, a build-up to this. And there were a number of factors which led up to what took place. One of them being a land dispute, where the compound of the Jamaat al-Muslimin, which comprised 8.8 acres of land, was divided into two, one parcel being state land given, the other part being so-called regional corporation land, and there was a dispute over some land. The army had moved in and occupied part of the land some months before the coup. And this land dispute, the government tried to litigate before the courts, and the matter was decided in favor of the Jamaat al-Muslimin by Justice Zainal Hussain. And the state appealed again, so desperate to take this land back from the Jamaat al-Muslimin, which for the most part up to that time was a social activist movement of Muslims who were feeding the poor, who were taking care of the sick, taking the orphans off the street, helping the needy and the homeless, giving shelter, taking in the orphans, and providing a social service. For some reason, the government, and we know how that story goes, wanted to take this land back. The Jamaat al-Muslimin won the case under Justice Zainal Hussain, and then the state appealed, and while the Muslims were in prison for the coup on February 26, 1991, the position, the victory of the Jamaat al-Muslimin was upheld by Justice James Davis, who sustained Justice Hussein's decision. And then, of course, the members of the Muslimin came out of prison in 1992. But I have a couple videos that have been circulating on this topic, and one of them, just a short 8-minute video, addresses something that I'm going to address. And also, I'm going to go through this part quickly. The making of the 1990 coup. What caused it? And I'm going to refer to Professor Selwyn Ryan's book, Muslimin Grab for Power, where he gives an account of the social situations in Trinidad and Tobago that caused the revolution. And this brings us to problem number one with the way that we think. Anytime there's anything in our vocabulary or in our history along the lines of insurrection, overthrow of government, revolution, rebellion, uprising, the people are programmed to just sit back and believe that there was no kind of rationality whatsoever involved in the process of making a decision to do something like this, and that the perpetrators were wild, crazy, bloodthirsty, savage, insane, and barbaric, and they, in this uncontrollable, thoughtless way, just did this crazy action unprovoked. But the alarming thing about it is, which was the case in 1990, because this was actually 1.5 to 2 years before I myself embraced Islam, joining the Nation of Islam in England. But I was there on July 27, 1990, but I was in the world. I was 19 years old, I'm on the streets, I'm drinking, you know, planning to go to some party later. And then when the news started to spread that this was happening, the people generally seemed happy. Because I was on the street and I was drinking and the bar sold out. People, it's like their mentality was, wow, finally someone did something. But then leading up to that, when a dominant national narrative began flooding the airwaves of the media, people's opinions began to slowly change. But let's be objective now about what would have caused the 1990 coup. So Professor Selwyn Ryan writes on page 270 of his book, The fact that the NAR government and its leadership was widely hated by large sections of the population, and that its social and economic policies were seen to be wicked, satanic, and uncaring, was an asset for Abu Bakr, who saw himself and was regarded by many as being a more caring and socially concerned leader than the Prime Minister, A.R. Robinson. There was at this time also allegations of government ministers and senior police officers being business partners with drug lords. During the 1980s, according to the Central Bank, per capita GNP had fallen from $7,560 US in 1982 to $3,480 US in 1987, and it dropped even lower in 1990. The cutbacks in the public and private expenditure aggravated the plight of the poor. Steve Solomon, secretary of the St. Vincent de Paul Society, observed that 1,200 poor families had been added to their list in 1989. The new poor were also flooding the offices of the Social Development and Family Services. Research conducted by senior economist Dr. Ralph Henry in 1989 revealed that some 22% of the population were living below the poverty line. Another University of the West Indies senior economist, Dennis Pantin, estimated that structural adjustment policies put in place between 1982 and 1990 led to an increase of 66,000 unemployed persons and 100,000 persons added to the poor category. Compensation of employees in central and local government bodies fell from $2.9 billion to $1.1 billion. In terms of revenue, the estimated contribution by individuals grew from 23% in 1975 to 43% in 1990. It goes on. One mayor of a southern town estimated that unemployment in his municipality among the youth was as high as 60%. Statistics on retrenchment, published and presented by the Minister of Labor, revealed that between 1986 and 1990, over 8,000 persons had been retrenched by private sector firms, and in 1987 alone, 3,360 persons were retrenched by 131 firms. In the midst of all of this, Imam Yasin Abu Bakr made a statement that some analysts saw as the trigger to the July 27th, 1990 coup, where he said, quote, "Amidst all the poverty and destitution, where people cannot find jobs, where there is no work, where children are reduced to crime in order to live, where there are no drugs in the hospital, the Prime Minister broke the camel's back when he said that $500,000 was going to be allocated for a stone monument for Gene Miles, who was a whistleblower against government corruption in the 1970s. He said, we could no longer take that kind of action from the leaders. This is the last straw. Now, all of that I mentioned there, those conditions, without having any inside knowledge or information on exactly what happened, that is what causes a revolution, a rebellion, or an uprising. It is conditions like that that cause unrest. And they get you, the people, to be more interested in protecting the piece of paper called the Constitution and upholding the illusion of democracy more so than the human rights and civil rights and justice for the masses of the people. So in other words, you can trample on the rights of the masses, but once you're upholding protection of the Constitution and democracy, you're doing a good job. And the public are brainwashed as part of the package of their illusion of equality under this citizenship. We're brainwashed to believe that all you have to do is defend the Constitution and democracy and everyone will be fine. Let's look a bit further. Around that time, and those of you who are old enough to remember will know, that there were all kinds of problems in Trinidad. There was the introduction of VAT, value-added tax, this 15% on everything, the removal of the cost of living allowance, the dollar was devalued, and there was an economist that was actually employed with the IMF from Trinidad, some say he's from Guyana, Davison Boodoo, who resigned from the IMF, and his resignation letter was an open press release, which was entitled IMF Playing with Numbers. And he accused the IMF, after working with them for many years, he accused the IMF of rigging figures in the Trinidad and Tobago economy for the purpose of unnecessarily devaluing our dollar. That's a whole other issue. So all of that's taken place, and then there were problems in the hospital. Shortage of medicines, no drugs, people suffering, on the verge of death because they needed specific medication. Imam Yasin Abubakar went to the Minister of Health, who was Dr. Emmanuel Hossain under the NAR government, and asked him for a list of drugs that were needed by the Trinidad and Tobago Ministry of Health to treat all of the patients in the hospital who were sick. Minister Dr. Emmanuel Hossain gave the list to Imam Abubakar, and through UNICEF, the Imam and the Islamic Call Society based in Libya under the leadership of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, they actually got the drugs. It was estimated to cost $800,000. The Jamaat al-Muslimin shipped the drugs in. And the Prime Minister, A.N.R. Robinson, on January 31st, 1990, wrote a letter to Imam Yasin Abubakar saying, "We will not be accepting your medication." On behalf of whom was that said? Were the sick people in the hospital of the opinion that, oh, they are terrorists or they're insurrectionists? The coup didn't even happen as yet. So was it the people in the hospital who were of the opinion, no, we should not take those drugs from these Muslims, we don't know what they're up to, etc., etc., etc.? But I mean, you see, that's why Professor Selwyn Ryan would have used that vocabulary, as in the policies being wicked, uncaring, and satanic. So that leads us to a statement made by A.N.R. Robinson, the Prime Minister at the time of the coup, that he made in Tobago. Now remember, A.N.R. Robinson used to be the Minister of Finance in the early 1970s in the PNM government of Dr. Eric Williams. He resigned as Minister of Finance due to his dissatisfaction with how his government was handling the Black Power Revolution. He went on to form his own Tobago-based party called the DAC, the Democratic Action Congress. And at one of the inaugural meetings of the DAC on November the 17th, 1974, 16 years before the coup, A.N.R. Robinson said the following, quote, "Trinidad and Tobago is headed straight towards a coup. And we ignore the warning signs at our peril." Then he says, "It is not I who am inviting the coup. It is they who are playing the fool in Parliament and making a mockery of democratic institutions." Just look at the last week in Trinidad. And look at what A.N.R. Robinson warned. Talking about a coup coming. And the reason for the coup is because there are those who are playing the fool in Parliament and making a mockery of democratic institutions. And then, of course, the army and the police, on instructions from the Minister of National Security, set up a camp on the Mukarrabo premises between the mosque and the supermarket on the Jamaat al-Muslimin's land. There's so many stories of the disrespect, the blatant disregard of the woman. And so when that day came, July 27, 1990, the Muslims took over the government, took over the television station, and went on to take control for 6 days. Now, I want to deal with one serious piece of propaganda, because there were a lot of newspaper articles at the time, and I want to direct you to my Gael television program. It's posted on my David Muhammad Facebook page, which I did, which has a lot of visual presentations on this same topic. Congratulations on a good job done. This is to the military. How the army won the war. They didn't win any war. And pictures of the few government members who were outside of the parliament, who were not taken hostage, in front of microphones and being flanked by soldiers and police officers, giving this illusion of control. And one of the biggest pieces of propaganda and the planted news stories which tried to give the impression that the military was in control, but one of the biggest pieces of propaganda is how they refer to that revolution. They use the term the attempted coup. And many people, in just repeating that old narrative, say the same thing. Oh, July 27, 1990, for 6 days, that was the attempted coup. Beloved, no, it was not an attempted coup. It was a successful coup, because the moment the government and its senior officials became inoperable and incapacitated, it was a successful insurrection. According to our constitution, there are three branches of government, which are the executive, judiciary, and legislature. The executive branch of government is the key authority in government, which, again, according to our constitution, comprises of three categories of persons. One, the prime minister. Two, the attorney general. And three, other government ministers. But you cannot have a cabinet, you cannot have an executive branch of government without those two key individuals, a prime minister and an attorney general. The prime minister was A&R Robinson. The attorney general was Selwyn Richardson. Both of them were hostages. Both of them were tied up. Incidentally, both of them were shot, incapacitated, and someone else on the outside had to assume among themselves who they are going to pretend is in power. But the government was incapacitated. They did not attempt to tie them up and they got away. They did not attempt to hold them hostage and they escaped. They held them there. But again, the perpetual political dishonesty to try to put an impression in the people's minds that this event was a failure on the part of the Muslims and successful on the part of the state. Well, I'll tell you in a short while exactly what they were successful in, because it's kind of embarrassing. So, the coup had taken place. It was not an attempt. It was successful. Then negotiations began. And there were four locations where these negotiations were taking place. The Red House, the Parliament building, where the Muslims were, with the Prime Minister and Attorney General and government ministers who were being held hostage. Television House, then Camp Ogden, the military base, and the fourth location was Hilton Hotel. And at all four of these locations, discussions were taking place between different groups, directly, indirectly, first hand, second hand. But those were the basic command centers regarding negotiations. And Anglican priest, our beloved friend, Canon Nolly Clark, was a mediator between the different sides. So, during this long night of July 27, 1990, Canon Nolly Clark was back and forth under a lot of stress, and also Mervyn Telfer, who was another chief negotiator, And look at how he describes the first night, Mervyn Telfer. He says, quote, "During the long night of July 27th, there was much confusion, uncertainty, and plain stupidity at Camp Ogden." Wow. See, that was the strongest authority that the government had at that time, the military. Professor Selwyn Ryan says, "Some army men were also driven to complain of the buffoonery of some of the politicians who gathered at Camp Ogden." Because remember, the main politicians, the Prime Minister, Attorney General, and government ministers were in the Red House. They were hostage. And so you had one or two others. For those of you who saw the Netflix series Designated Survivor, right, where they say that it's United States law that you always have one person, a member of cabinet, away from all the others, just in case something happens, all of the entire government is killed in some terrorist attack, and so you must have someone left back. And that's what the series Designated to Survivors about. Sorry if that was a spoiler for you, but that's what they advertise it as anyway. And so that's kind of like what it was like at Camp Ogden in Trinidad. It's like the Designated Survivors who weren't hostages were there with the leadership in the military. And apparently they weren't being very respected. Ryan says, "The mood of the Muslimin changed during the night once negotiations were begun, from one of utter violence to one of accommodation. From Sunday morning onward," remember that happened on a Friday evening, "the treatment became more humane. Winston Dukeran was chosen as acting prime minister by the Muslimin." Now remember, when Bazdeo Pandey was elected and he was referred to as the first Indian prime minister of Trinidad and Tobago, Imam Yasin Abubakar would jokingly say, "No, the first Indian prime minister of Trinidad was Winston Dukeran." And he said, "I appointed him." John Humphrey, who was a former minister of housing, can't remember exactly what he was at the time, but one of the government ministers, in the negotiations had suggested that the political settlement which the Jamaat al-Muslimin wished for to effect could be achieved within the context of the existing constitution. Let me cut to the chase on that. Many of the government officials, one by one, slowly but surely, began to empathize with the cause of Imam Yasin Abubakar and the Jamaat al-Muslimin. Let's look further. Prime Minister A.R. Robinson, in an interview with the Caribbean News Agency and the BBC, said, quote, "After very lengthy negotiations with the Jamaat al-Muslimin, an agreement has been reached, and we are due to evacuate the Red House as soon as conditions are laid in the country." That was Sunday evening. The coup took place on Friday evening. 2 days later, they reached agreements. But they didn't come out until 6 days later. Why were they kept in for so long? Selwyn Richardson, Attorney General, said, quote, "After very statesmanlike negotiations with both Mr. Robinson, our Prime Minister, and Mr. Bilal Abdullah, the heads of agreement were reached." Selwyn Richardson, on page 145 of the book Muslimin Grab for Power, said, or Professor Selwyn Ryan says, "Following the ending of the crisis, attempts were made to deny that the police cursed and abused the Prime Minister and threatened to kill him if he ventured outside of the Parliament. All of you talking about attempted coup, an insurrection, and so many people died, that bogus statement, which we're going to deal with in a little while. How many of you know about this? That after 2 days, according to all of the records, the government of the NAR under A.R. Robinson and the Jamaat al-Muslimin came to a complete agreement on all issues. A.R. Robinson was like, okay, we're good. We're ready to come out now. And they were cursed by the military, who did not want it to end like that. And some of them were so trigger happy, undisciplined, just shooting nonstop at the buildings for no reason, putting both hostages and hostage takers at risk. I mean, it's like you lock them in a room to look at a whole lot of Westerns on rerun for weeks and then put guns in their hand and say, go. It was embarrassing. Those parliamentarians who were in the Red House, however, insisted that the police were abusive to them and that the heavy shelling of the Red House continued from Friday evening all the way up nonstop to Saturday night, despite the presence of Canon Nolly Clark, the Anglican priest who was the chief negotiator, who risked his life to return to Parliament with the signed amnesty. That is the main thing that was being blocked. The fact that there was an official pardon for what the Muslimin did. At Television House now, moving away from the Red House, journalist, legendary journalist, Raul Pantin wrote, quote, "Those men had discipline, seriousness of purpose, seriousness of faith and commitment. That's not your everyday criminal. Why, Raul Pantin asked, are people on the outside so anxious to deny that?" Raul Pantin, according to Selwyn Ryan, was impressed by the solicitude which Abu Bakr and his men showed for their hostages, whom they promised to protect from harm, even at the expense of their own lives. No TTT hostage was physically abused, tied up, or wired. Now let's be objective about this. Those talking about terrorism. Yes, the police headquarters was blown up. But the imam stood at the bottom of the headquarters with a megaphone evacuating the building. Can you really fit that in the category of terrorism as we understand? Could you imagine the 9/11 terror attacks on the Twin Towers in New York, the two pilots at the foot of the buildings evacuating the buildings first before they fly the planes into them? Abu Bakr saw Auntie Hazel, who was working at TTT at the time, and asked her, "What are you doing here, Auntie Hazel? This is not somewhere for you to be right now. Please go ahead." And Auntie Hazel said, "Yes, you're right. This is not somewhere where I need to be right now." And she left. None of the hostages were abused. At TTT, there was no acts of violence against them. And the only two really who were victims of that kind of treatment were the two key characters of the government, the Prime Minister and the Attorney General. For the first 2 or 3 hours after the Muslimin took members of the government hostage, there was no visible on-duty members of the protective services in the city, and citizens began to loot. I remember being on St. Vincent Street and seeing a police officer with his shirt untucked and all of his appointments, numbers and everything moved. And I remember asking him, say, "You a police?" And he didn't answer me. He was actually standing on the corner. And I remember seeing two young men breaking a car window with a brick. I didn't stick around to see that. I was constantly on the move around there, carib in hand. Brainwashed youth as I was at the time. Now, let's talk for a moment about the looting. Because this was another key issue, and it exposed something. And one of the most memorable statements coming out of the entire July 27, 1990 coup was a statement by the leader of the 1970 Black Power Revolution in Trinidad, Macandal Dagga, who said, describing Trinidad and Tobago, basically, we live in a country where people are willing to risk their lives under a hail of bullets for a block of cheese. Now, I've been talking about this quite a bit recently, where you had and have people talking, but oh, so many people died. People using the term bloody, bloody coup. That was almost a bloodless revolution. And I've spoken about the television interview I did recently, where I had to ask the interviewer, you know, someone, how many people died? It was so terrible and traumatic and... Okay, fine, I understand that if you lost a loved one. We must respect that. But I asked brother, I said, how many people died at the hands of the Muslims in that coup? And he said, people died in the Red House, people died at the police station, people died at the television house, people died on the street. I said, hold up. I said, two people died at the hands of the Muslims. But the death toll was 38. Who killed the other 36? It was the police. And some of us as brainwashed simpletons want to say, well, if the Muslims didn't start the act in the first place, then the police wouldn't have killed anyone. Oh, so are you saying that someone can throw a firecracker as a distraction, and as a result of that, I throw a hand grenade and kill a whole lot of people, and then blame the person who threw the firecracker? Let's not be ignorant on this. And when we say 36 people were killed by the police, we're not talking about around the Red House or at Television House. We're talking about in supermarkets, in stores, in appliance shops. And this is one of my biggest issues with this bogus narrative about the July 27th, 1990 coup. That you love to use this language about upholding the Constitution and defending democracy and honoring the Westminster system and holding the parliamentary chamber as sacred. That is garbage. We have inherited a broken, corrupted, decrepit system of Westminster-style European government of oppression on all these former slave societies. And again, we bow down and worship this constitution and so-called democracy while we trample on the rights of the people. And if you're going to say that the military during the coup were defending democracy and defending the constitution, I am asking you, why were they killing people, shooting, wounding and injuring people who were taking food? All of that is more the more reason why the coup was held in the first place. Because people were poor, hungry, ragged, naked, out of doors, suffering, oppressed, and exploited. And now, there's no law and order in the society. There's chaos. And they run into a supermarket to try to get bread and milk and rice and flour and sugar. And they're willing to risk their lives for it. So how come the police and the soldiers that were so preoccupied on protecting white people's businesses more so than they were interested in protecting the lives of black people? This is one of the ugliest parts of this entire coup. It was a loud and clear message about the state of poverty of the nation, and an even louder and clearer message was sent in the weeks that followed when armed soldiers and police went into poor communities in East Port of Spain, Laventil, Beetham, Sealots, kicked down the doors of residents. And in their own personal estimation, they looked around your house. And if they saw a fridge or a freezer or a stove or a washing machine or a dryer or a furniture set or a television set that looked as if it was too new, and you looked as if you were too poor and black and you could not produce a receipt for those new items in your house, they, with their big trucks, seized your items and put it right back on their trucks and took it away from you And many hard-working, innocent, poor black people lost property that they paid their hard-earned money for. And that's what our military were doing at the time when they were supposed to be so-called defending democracy and upholding the Constitution. That's sickening. And you still up to this day. So on one hand, police killing people, shooting and injuring people in supermarkets. On the other hand, they're kicking down people's doors, taking back the property owned by the white people in the appliance stores. And we just, now we weren't thinking this way at the time, but years later with all that brainwashing narratives, the so-called upkeepers of the law. Beloved, a group called the Movement for Social Transformation, in a statement that they released right after the coup, said, quote, "The massive looting that took place in Port of Spain and along the East-West Corridor is primarily a reflection of the deep poverty and tremendous hardships experienced by the people." They went on to say that these events have been described as IMF riots, International Monetary Fund riots, because they occur when the people have been driven to desperation by IMF and World Bank policies embraced by the government. Medical practitioner Dr. Jeffrey Frankson said, quote, expressing his opinion, "It was not the masses, but the businessmen who started the looting." Dr. Franson felt it was only a minority of the poor urban population which had gone on a looting rampage, and that the looters were economically hurt by the policies of the NAR government. These are the honest, immediate, observable reactions of the people at the time. Senator Diana Mahabia Wyatt, who is a local Trinidad white woman, listen to what she said, quote, "As soon as the official looting began, every manjack there joined in. And for once, there was no racial divisions. They were all thieves. The whites looting at Glencoe and St. Anne's, and the blacks and Indians looting in Port of Spain." To this day, the question of who burnt all of those buildings down in Port of Spain remains a mystery to some, not to all of us. Many of those same downtown business owners, many of those same ones who own the cloth stores, who disrespect our black women who work in there, who get sometimes 10 and 15 minutes for lunch, who have to count the amount of squares of toilet paper they give them to go to the washroom, and they have the abusive, nasty, dirty son or grandson of the owner as a floor supervisor in the shops, with his problems in keeping his hands to himself. Well, in our Quran, it talks about how to deal with men like that. But the Muslims were in two places. The Red House on Abercrombie Street and St. Vincent Street in Port of Spain, and TTT all the way uptown, Maraval Road. But someone is starting to light fires in all of these buildings, all of these cloth stores owned by those who will be referred to as the 1% today. Mass fires in cascading effect. The Muslims didn't do that. Nobody who was looting did that. Was there ever an investigation into the insurance payouts from the destruction of all of those buildings in Port of Spain? And all of that they want to blame on the Jamaat. What's wrong with you all? So let's look at some of the political reactions. I'm monitoring the time here. Government members, Kelvin Ramnath, parliamentarians, and said that Selwyn Richardson, Attorney General, was impressed by the discipline of the Muslimin members and how they had conducted themselves and even offered to precept them to be able to keep their guns and play an important role in the defense of our country. These are the hostages, government members, parliamentarians who were hostages, said these things. John Humphrey, another parliamentarian who's a hostage, said, the Attorney General, Selwyn Richardson, acted as if he was Bilal Abdullah's second in command during the crisis. Trevor Sudama said, another parliamentarian, even on the two-way radio, I heard expletives, which confirmed in my mind that the police cared very little about the lives of the hostages. Kelvin Ramnath also said in a subsequent parliamentary hearing, quote, you would be surprised at the kind of replies that came back to the Prime Minister on the radio from the military. Bas Diopande said of the 1990 coup, quote, I could have seen that frustration building up among the unemployed, and everyone could have seen it, but the government could not have seen it. Here in Trinidad, people were poor and then tasted of the good life and then suddenly became poor again. That created a revolutionary situation. Only the insensitive would not have realized the depth of alienation that would have been created. You are alienating the people, and by ignoring them, you are inviting the events of July 27, 1990. Now, Bas Diopande was one of many examples of politicians who twisted their own tongues to give an opposite opinion to what they originally said about the coup. And in November 1998, at the memorial for the great Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael, which was held at the Emancipation Support Committee's headquarters up in Maraval, Imam Yasin Abubakar there officially revealed, even though he said it before, he officially revealed that the two men who went on to become Prime Minister, Bas Diopande and Patrick Manning, both had prior knowledge in advance of the July 27th, 1990 coup. Both men who were sitting members of parliament did not show up in the parliament on that day. There was always speculation as to whether or not they were forewarned, but the Imam Yasin Abubakar in November 1998 confirmed, yes, both of them knew. And both of them also at different times, based on the political arrangement of the day, depending on the election at hand, gave varying views about Imam Yasin Abubakar and the Jamaat al-Muslimin. Look at what Bas Diopande said again. Look at it. Of the 1990 coup, former prime minister, he said, I could have seen that frustration building up among the unemployed, and everyone could have seen it, but the government could not see it. Here in Trinidad, people were poor and then tasted of the good life and then suddenly became poor again. That created a revolutionary situation. He said that created a revolutionary situation. He didn't say, well, they were just some crazy, wild insurrectionists who were aimless without guidance. No, he said that the poverty, the unemployment, and the frustration due to the economic situation, that created the revolutionary situation. In a poll, the SARA poll conducted in September 1990, after the events, 41% of the respondents maintained a negative attitude towards the Prime Minister, A.N.R. Robinson, and 32% were even less sympathetic towards him, which is 73% of the people were against the Prime Minister. 51% said elections should be called within 6 months, which was one of the conditions that they initially agreed to, but then turned around on. But when it came to deciding which political party was best to handle the problems that the country was facing, 31% said none, and 23% said they don't know. That is 54%, more than half of the people, it would appear, were disenchanted with the politics. Now, we're on the home stretch here, because I want to talk about probably the most forgotten aspect of the entire 1990 coup, which was the amnesty. These men were officially pardoned by the state. These men were officially pardoned by the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago through the acting president, who had assigned amnesty. Now listen to this. The amnesty was negotiated on the first 2 days and agreed to, but the president had to be in on it as well. And it was finally negotiated and signed by acting president Joseph Emmanuel Carter on July 28th, 1990. That was the Saturday. That was the next day. Remember, they stayed in there for 6 days. Because the army had took control, and you say that was an attempted coup? Well, so the amnesty was signed by acting president Joseph Emmanuel Carter the next day, promising that there will be no state prosecution against the insurrectionists of the Jamaat al-Muslimin for the entire event. Within the provisions of the amnesty, it stated that the amnesty was granted to, quote, signed by the president of the republic, all those involved in acts of insurrection commencing approximately 5:30 p.m. on Friday, July 27th, 1990, and ending upon the safe return of all members of parliament held captive on July 27th, 1990. Agreements in the document were drawn up by Mr. Joseph Tony, member of parliament, who had also drafted the letter of resignation, which Prime Minister Robinson and all other parliamentarians had agreed to sign. Soldiers, after they came out, who later stripped and beat members of the Jamaat al-Muslimin looking for this document, were not aware that it had been photocopied. It was argued later that the amnesty was signed under duress and therefore null and void, even though President Joseph Emmanuel Carter, who signed it, was not a hostage and was nowhere near the Red House nor TTT. The members of the Jamaat al-Muslimin went on to spend 2 years in prison. And guess where the idea came to make copies of the amnesty? From one of the parliamentarians who was a hostage. Because it was clear to them, at one point it was like, okay, so it's the Muslims and the hostages who are under attack from the military. The military were just firing nonstop. It's a miracle they had bullets left after all of that. And now the Muslims are telling the hostages, don't worry, we will protect you. Minister of Sport, Jennifer Johnson, spoke about how blown away she was by these young men and how disciplined they were and how they respected women, ensured that they had their privacy and that they were taken care of, and that all of the hostages were given food to eat before the Muslims themselves had food to eat. Carl Hudson Phillips was quoted as saying on page 169 of Professor Ryan's book, quote, "My personal position and the position of any right-thinking member of the population should and must be that one doesn't care whether or not an amnesty was given, having regard to the circumstances in which any such document came into existence. Prime Minister Robertson's quoted as saying later on that his captors gravely miscalculated the mood of the people of Trinidad and Tobago. So, the key points coming out of this are, one, key individuals who occupied positions of leadership in Trinidad in the seat of Prime Minister for the next 20 years had prior knowledge of the 1990 coup. But even though there were elections in 1995, 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2007, in those five elections, the story of the 1990 coup was used like a political football for mileage. Because on one side, the one party was supported and embraced the assistance of the Jamaat al-Muslimin, and then on the other occasion, the other side did. Also, a number of other government officials from various other administrations were also aware of the plans prior to the event, because there was a group called SOPO that was formed in 1988, Summit of the People's Organizations, where you had trade unions, smaller political parties, activist groups, and multiple other individuals and organizations that formed SOPO, and the Jamaat al-Muslimin was part of it. And it is widely stated that the discussions to overthrow the government took place in SOPO. And you had persons who were in SOPO who were senators up to last year. And there were also a number of other individuals, including members of the protective services, that were also involved, some who did not participate at the last minute. And, of course, in March 1998, the Jamaat al-Muslimin again found themselves in a standoff with the state, this time when the UNC government tried to take back a parcel of land, just under 4 acres of land, that was granted to the Muslimins in 1969. And, of course, Imam Yasin Abu Bakr, born on October 18, 1941, passed away just some days ago on October 21st, 2021. And from the time of the coup to now, the Imam has continued his mission for the 30th anniversary of the 1990 coup. Imam Yasin Abu Bakr released a statement, and I close with this. He said, quote, on the 30th anniversary of the coup, the police murdered and tortured our families who were not combatants while we were in TTT and the Red House. They destroyed all we built, a number one Mukarrabo Road, except our mosque. They destroyed our outreach centers and our bakeries. We remember the lives of Abdul Karim, Jasani Omowali, and Bernadette James, all killed by the police in the lead up to the U.S. arresting politicians for their crimes. I have to say something about Bernadette James real quick, because a former attorney general in the NAR government was in a meeting in the airport, according to reports. And Bernadette James, who was a member of the protective services, accidentally walked into the room where this member of government was in a meeting with a drug lord. And apparently there was a kilogram of cocaine on the table. Some discussion was taking place, and she walked in, obviously embarrassed, and then next thing we know, she was in an exercise in Tucker Valley. This would have been October 1987. She's sitting in a bus, and she is mysteriously shot in the head. Her mother went to visit the Imam, crying out for justice, that her daughter witnessed a government minister and a drug lord making a deal at the airport. She was shot in the head mysteriously. Up to today, we were able to get some new information on the individual who actually pulled the trigger, who we understand went on to head a new department in a Syrian-owned security company that gets mega contracts from the government. And apparently he migrated since then. But there was a similar situation with an East Indian soldier who was shot by accident as well. His name was Omar Samaru. What did Omar Samaru witness? Well, they say Omar Samaru was the witness. I have the whole screen here. And again, look out for my Gael television program. We'll run it again through the week, but it's on my David Muhammad Facebook page. The children of another attorney general, interestingly, apparently were let up onto a fire range and were allowed to handle high-powered weapons for target practice. And they posed in pictures that ended up on social media. And this soldier, Omar Samaru, who was a key witness in that case, shot accidentally. Just like Bernadette James in 1987, October, sitting on a bus after witnessing a government minister and a drug lord together in a meeting, shot mysteriously in the head. So Abu Bakr continues, 30th anniversary of the coup. He said, we remember the lives of Abdul Karim Jisani Omowale and Bernadette James, all killed by the police in the lead up to United States arresting politicians locally for their crimes. We ensure that anyone who was shot or injured, including Mr. Robinson, who was the major cause of the entire revolution, was sent for treatment to preserve their life. We did what we had to do. I did not apologize because I did nothing wrong. There is nothing to apologize for. I will be suing any news agency that stated or states that I have apologized for the 1990 revolution. I will be suing any news agency that defames my character. We have thousands of members, children and grandchildren. We can no longer accept the demonization pushed in the society. The truth will help to heal and help us to grow together. Let us stop the biased lies. The Privy Council upheld our amnesty and released us from prison. That is the law. Do you all believe in the law? Was the Privy Council wrong? Were the people wrong for voting out the NAR government in 1992? The reasons why we took such brave, serious action are most important. We need to address the causes so government doesn't cause another uprising from the people. I remain a humble servant to my nation, a rock against oppression. I love the people of Trinidad and Tobago. I love my country. All praises due to Allah, Imam Yasin Abu Bakr. Now, I close saying this. In my humble opinion, Imam Yasin Abu Bakr showed Trinidad and Tobago society how to be a man. How to believe in something and stand up for it. A wise man once said, if you don't stand up for something, you will fall for anything. And if you don't have an agenda of your own, you'll become part of someone else's. Too many men in our society grumble, fuss, complain, argue, and gossip, but do nothing about what they're complaining, bickering, squabbling, and quarreling about. This is almost like a continued feminization of the men in our society. So many men in our nation, and I don't want to... Too many men in our country are cowards. With no disrespect, no sexism, I say this in tradition. Too many grown men in our society are like little women. They gossip, especially on behalf of these political parties. They gossip and bad talk and slack talk and back talk. And when it comes to standing up for a cause for justice and believing in something, they're afraid. Whether you agree with Imam Yasin Abu Bakr or not, you should take a page from his book on how to represent an ideology that you have embraced. I am a Muslim. a student of the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And we are taught from the Holy Quran that persecution is worse than slaughter, and it is better to die standing on your feet fighting for justice than to live crawling on your knees as a slave being in fear to a man. We are taught that we must fear nothing and no one but Almighty God, Allah. And if you are afraid of a man, or if you are afraid of the system more so than you're afraid of the consequences of disobeying God's law, well, then you might as well stop worshiping God and worship the man you fear instead, because you have just made him your God besides Allah. We do still live under the same wicked system, but as a student of Minister Farrakhan, our political position when it comes to this system of injustice is separation from it. We must unite and build a black economy. We must establish skills banks and think tanks. We must network with one another, support black business, and create our own institutions. The COVID-19 pandemic should have taught us this now, but we had to embrace this consciousness even before. And we have to continue the struggle. This is why I've never supported any of your political parties. This is why I've never voted in any of your elections. And for those of you who want to speak evil of me for my steadfast position in not supporting any of your politicians, the same thing that I'm saying now is the same thing that I've been saying from 30 years ago. I've never grasshopped from supporting one group to another. I've remained primarily a Muslim in my beliefs. And I'm not going to compromise that for your dirty, filthy, corrupt, backstabbing, backbiting, scandal-mongering political culture. Hell no. So I say Trinidad and Tobago has lost a great citizen, and in my personal opinion, a greater man than any one who has ever occupied any of our seats of power in any political office, or from any senator, prime minister, president, parliamentarian, judge, or magistrate. I wouldn't trade any of them for Imam Yasin Abu Bakr. And I pray that in this information that we shared this evening, that you would have picked out the historical truths about the looting, about the burning of the buildings, about the amnesty that was signed by the president, that was upheld by the Privy Council, all of this that you probably did not know before, or that you knew but forgot. Let us be open-minded and objective. So the history of the July 27, 1990 coup, like so many of my topics, are in my book, Black Studies. Go to the website, www.blackagendaproject.com. This is the same site with our online radio station. But go to blackagendaproject.com. You can get the instant digital download. This is 433 pages, over 388 references. Powerful information. Knowledge is power, beloved. Get Black Studies. So you can get either the physical copy mailed to you, or you can get the digital download that downloads straight onto your tablet or computer or iPad, and the other books as well. And beloved, last thing, key, this Saturday, October 30th, we host African Expo number 9. We have had 8 successful African Expos where we bring together black business, we network, we support, we exchange contact details and ideas, and then we link with each other, and then grow and expand, and then network further. and establish our skills bank and think tank and have it grow further. The Black Agenda Project organization, based on the 9 ministries from the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan: health, agriculture, education, security, arts and culture, justice, information, science, technology, and business. And we have our 9 committees. We must organize. You could go ahead and vote. I will never discourage you from voting. But you cannot vote your way out of these problems here. So, beloved, I want to thank you. Hope to see you at the Kwame Ture Center this Saturday for African Expo number 9. And we're also going to have one at the end of November and one for Kwanzaa in December. But this one is going to be a great one. There's going to be great food. There's going to be art. There's going to be African clothes and other clothes. There's going to be books. There's going to be technology, phones and tablets. There's going to be all kinds of delicacies, jewelry, so many different things. I can never do justice in advertising like that, but come down. Kwame Ture Center, there's so much going on there, beloved. But thank you so much. Remember, go to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Black Agenda Project. Make sure you like it. Go through the videos. There's one on the 1990 coup. On my Facebook page, David Muhammad, you'll get the visual images from the 1990 coup. Again, a lecture with some of the similar content from this from my Gael TV program. And I thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'll be back on, of course, next week, Wednesday, every Wednesday now, 8 o'clock. And I've switched to the Black Agenda Project Facebook page. All right. We're about to hit 20,000 followers on this page. And we have another about 16,000 on the other page. And then other thousands on TikTok. And we just crossed, I think, 14,000 likes on TikTok. So it's spreading. The consciousness is spreading. So let's help in that regard as well. Thank you so much. And may Almighty God Allah continue to bless you as I greet you in peace. Assalamu alaikum.